Registration is now open for the 2018 Apologetics Canada Conference. The conference is located in beautiful Abbotsford, British Columbia on March 2nd and 3rd. We have another amazing lineup of speakers. Get all the details and register at apologeticscanadaconference.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
Terry.
Hello.
Hello. Like, I'm afraid of asking Terry what he has, because he comes up with some
What you found, Terry?
Okay, people want to know what you guys put on your toast in the morning. That's what they want to know right now.
Well, you know, that makes an assumption, Terry.
That you eat toast?
Yeah.
Okay, if you have bread products or buns, what do you put on your toast?
I typically put on jam, typically strawberry jam. Mm.
No butter, just straight up jam?
If I have butter, I'll put on butter, but my default is strawberry jam. Hmm.
I don't eat toast. If I did, though, I'd definitely slap some margarine on there and slap some strawberry jam. But when I turned 35 and began my descent into the 40s.
Hey, that's one more year, eh? Just
thanks for putting that out there, Terry.
It's about a month closer, isn't it?
Yeah. The old metabolism ain't what she used to be.
No.
And, you
know.
And, you know.
Fast.
Oh, yeah. The sausage egg McMuffin for breakfast just sits right on
the side of your gut.
It's not really an option anymore. So breakfast for me tends to be either just fruit or oatmeal. Oatmeal seems to be the breakfast of choice.
Do you guys like
days.
Nutella?
Oh, I love Nutella.
My boys like it. I'm not a huge fan.
Nutella caused riots.
What happened?
They went on sale for 70% off, and there were major fights in the store itself.
Really?
Yeah.
Sorry, this was in
France.
French people love themselves some Nutella.
Oh, boy. One guy says, seriously, this is not normal after seeing people punch each other. One person had a black
sounds like
eye.
Black Friday at a Walmart.
I know.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
That's
this
what
is
I
over
thinking.
Nutella. I'm like, I'm sorry, but Nutella's not that great, is it? Oh, or are we going to get hate mail for me saying that? I don't like it too much.
Yeah, it definitely is not worth fighting over.
Yeah, I like it, but I would never punch somebody in the face to get Nutella.
It says, a woman had her hair pulled and an elderly lady took a box to the head.
That is unbelievable.
And another had a bloody hand.
For Nutella.
There's a video on it on Twitter, if you use Twitter.
Yeah, I do not.
You can see it, and there's riots. Yeah. Wow. It happened across
Did they explain why they dropped the price of Nutella, like why it was on sale?
No, it didn't come to that. It wasn't even sanctioned by Ferrero, the people that make Nutella. It was like some distribution company.
Just had too much Nutella
and
had to
wanted to get rid of it, and it incited riots.
Trouble in France over Nutella.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Our American listeners should be feeling a little bit better about themselves right now.
And the fight they got in on Black Friday for the pair of socks.
Yeah.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah, that was worth a box to the head.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Well, this is human condition.
That's right.
It's not just Americans, not just the French. Speaking of human. We're doing this series on the Human Project. Last week, we talked about the question, what is human? And if you're just kind of tuning in for the first time, you might want to go back to our previous episode and listen to that one first and just kind of check out what the Human Project is, how it came about.
Yeah, this is a series of talks we're doing leading up to the launch of the Human Project. Mm-hmm. And then these can be used for people as they're hosting the Human Project, they can reference these talks.
Yeah, and if you're familiar with the Thinking series, which we put out a couple of years ago, the format is basically the same.
By the way, before we get into things, I was just speaking out in Edmonton at a church, and I just want to give a shout out to some of our diehard listeners that I met out there. But one of the things that was really interesting is I met a group of people that are using the Thinking series in a way that I haven't seen yet.
Really?
Yeah, they watch the Thinking series before they run their alpha program. And they use it as training to get themselves prepped on how to answer and dialogue on questions that are raised around their tables.
Well, that must be kind of gratifying for you, because that's, in effect, that's how you came
that's how
to
it all
create.
Came to, yeah, it got started.
Yeah.
Was a group hosting Alpha at a coffee shop, and and realized they there were some questions being asked that were more fundamental to Alpha that they needed help addressing.
Yeah.
So there you go. Look forward to see how people are going to use this resource. Yeah. Oh, by the way, we should just let people know if you are wanting to get more information on this, check out thehumanproject.ca.
That's right. For this week's episode, we're going to be addressing the question of what is the value of human life? Now, I remember reading the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights for the first time. If you are at all familiar with it, the preamble begins with, whereas the recognition of the inherent dignity of humans.
Dignity is another word for value.
Right. For me, that's where I just kind of had to stop. I was like, whoa, that's a huge assumption. Where did that come from?
Yeah, and let's just pause there for a moment. Inherent meaning you came into the world with dignity or value. No one gave it to you. Mm-hmm. You already had it. That's huge. And by the way, when I read that too, because then it goes on to explain not only that you have inherent dignity or value, but that also that humanity is equal with inalienable rights, meaning rights that can't be taken away from you. And as I began to read that document, I began to think, wow, I can't wait to see them support those claims. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's huge, right? Well, you get through that document and you see that there's absolutely no argumentation given.
It's silent. It's just by fiat, it is asserted.
That it's recognized.
Then, yeah, it's recognized, and then it's just silent.
Well, which is interesting because this document comes out at about the time of the Nuremberg trials, just thereafter.
1948, I think.
And the Nuremberg trials were based on the same idea, the principle of a recognition that there is a suprapositive, that there's a law above the law, and that this is the law that the Nazis were held accountable to. Right. So it gets interesting when you start to see that framework of where this comes in. Now, I want to give a little bit more historical background to what took place before that document was created. I mean, what inspired this group to create that document? And one of the things that we do in the Human Project is we take a moment to look at history and just go, okay, what can we learn from the past? Now, we know that it was the Nazis, in particular their crimes against humanity, that were taken to task in the Nuremberg trials and ultimately inspired this document of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that you talked about, Steve. But a lot of people don't know where that term, crimes against humanity, originated. That it in fact originated in King Leopold II's rule over the Congo, which is something that we start out the session by talking about. So in session two, we begin by talking about King Leopold, how he gets a hold of the Congo and immediately begins to enslave the people. It was a famous novel written by Joseph Conrad called The Heart of Darkness. And I remember reading that in high school. And I think what a shame that I read this novel in high school and had no idea what it was talking about. And no history was given. And in fact, I don't know about you guys, but when I read it in high school, they said that, you know, they didn't even know where it actually took place because no specific location's given. However, Joseph Conrad was a steamboat captain in the Congo and had a front row seat to Leopold's barbarism. And this was ultimately the inspiration for this novel. And I think what a shame that so many people have no idea the history that Belgium had there in the Congo, and that within 23 years, King Leopold II was responsible for the death of over 10 million Congolese.
During the Holocaust, I believe 6 million Jews were exterminated, plus a whole bunch of other people, right?
You know, the so Poles, it rounded out to gypsies. Around 10 million.
Yeah.
So they're on par.
Yeah. That's pretty crazy because we think of some kind of a mass killing, kind of that sort of tragedy. Immediately we think of the Holocaust, but we hardly ever give any thought to what happened in the Congo.
This phrase then, crimes against humanity, comes about from a Christian pastor by the name of George Williams, who hears about what's going on, tells Leopold, hey, I want to go see for myself what's going on there. Leopold says, no way. But at that time, by the way, if you owned a colony, you were the one who could say who could come and go. And so Leopold said no, and he said, I'm going anyways. he goes to the Congo and sees the horrific events that are taking place there and the way that these Congolese people are treated. And he writes an open letter to the world detailing the, quote, crimes against humanity that are going on there. And through his work, this ultimately was stopped. But sadly, we have a history of this kind of violence. And this phrase, crimes against humanity, would be used again the next time to take the Nazis to task for what they did to the Jews. Now, one of the reasons why I want to bring this up is because an important historical question that we have to ask ourselves is, how is this possible? How is it possible for human beings to commit these kinds of crimes against one another? And this is a foundational question that we have got to get, that we must understand if we're going to stop history from repeating itself. Because what I find, and we talked a little bit about this last time, is that people have this assumption that these horrendous events in the past were committed by horrible people. But the truth is that they, in fact, were committed by ordinary people who had a dangerously distorted worldview. Now, I bring that up because this is one of the key aspects of the Human Project, is that we need to make sure that we have a clear perspective of people, because we can get a distorted perspective of another human being as well, and just as easily be capable of dehumanizing another, or devaluing, in this case, another human being, which, of course, happens through dehumanization. And I just want to raise this question or make this point by asking a simple question, a question that we asked last time. And that is, if you could go back in time and if you could talk with King Leopold II and ask him, you know, don't you think it's wrong to enslave people? You know, don't you think it's wrong to murder people? Again, likely he would have told you, of course it is. But then he would have explained to you that the Congolese are not people. That in fact, as was being taught in universities such as Harvard and Princeton, they're monkeys. Sub-Saharan Africans were referred to as a monkey. They were a missing link between by the way, this is a historical some historical context that might be interesting to people. In the past, at that time, they didn't see chimpanzees as, or in this day and age, the bonobo, as man's closest relative. They saw the orangutan. And this was powerfully demonstrated, the worldview at that time, when in 1906, a pygmy from the Congo, a man by the name of Oda Banga, was brought and displayed in the monkey house at the Bronx Zoo in New York, and he was caged with an orangutan. And thousands of people came to the zoo to see this exhibit.
And wasn't it a minister that came by afterwards to free Oda Banga?
Well, there was a minister by the name of Robert MacArthur who came to the zoo one day and saw this exhibit and said, absolutely no way.
I believe there were two ministers, right? Robert MacArthur came and just kind of exposed this, and then later
he saw it, and then he went back and started speaking to a group of clergy and said, you know, listen, we've got to speak out against this, and kind of helped rally a group of clergy that was then led by Reverend James Gordon. And then together as a group, they were successful in freeing Oda Banga.
Yeah. And Robert MacArthur was
Caucasian. Yeah.
And then James Gordon was African American.
That's right? Correct.
So this was like across the racial lines.
And I think that's important to understand, right?
Yeah.
Is that Christians across the lines, you know, ethnic lines, they understood that this was horrendous.
Right.
And needed to be stopped. Now, I think it's important, though, that we mention at the same time, you've got this happening in the Congo, and you've got a number of Christians that are speaking out against this. And in fact, George Williams gives his life for this. He died on his return journey from the Congo. You've got, on the other side of the pond, if you will, you know, here in Canada, you've got the exact opposite thing taking place. I think it's important, though, that we take, before we get too deep into this, that we just take a moment to see there has been a long history of Christians getting this right, you know, fighting dehumanization and fighting for humanizing other individuals. But we also have a history where we've gotten it wrong.
Yeah, unfortunately, our history here in Canada extends way back, even back to the 1600s, when Franciscans even set up residential schools for kids in Canada back then. Mm-hmm. And since that time to the present time, that's been a huge issue of dehumanization. I mean, it typically earmarks is, calling them savages.
Right.
They were less than human.
It is interesting, isn't it, that you've got that the time of the Congo and that's being fought by George Williams and others. Here in Canada, you've got in 1876 the Indian Act that began. In which the well-known phrase was used, the explicit purpose of this was to, quote, kill the Indian and the child. And it refers back to this idea of a savage, right?
Yeah.
These people were seen as savages. They were seen as less than human.
Yeah.
That needed to be civilized.
They needed to be civilized. And they needed, in order to do that, was to take them away from their parents, who were savages just as much, right? So in order to take that influence away, they needed to be separated from their parents to civilize them.
And I think this is an important point of the Indian Act that a lot of people don't understand, that was incredibly dehumanizing and devaluing, is that these children were specifically not just removed from their parents' homes, but taken far away, so far that the parents had no chance to go and visit that child, right? I mean, that was part of the civilization process that they had of killing the Indian and the child.
And the separation came from different angles too, right? Because the children are taken away from the parents at a very young age, and they don't learn their mother tongue. So then when they go back to the parents eventually, they can't even communicate.
Right.
I mean, what a tragedy.
There was a lot of separation, not only from the parents and the distance, but part of this story is my story because my mom is a residential school survivor.
And yeah, tell people a little bit about that. Where was she living? What school did
she was in Quebec, and she was one day visited upon by a government official and said, "You guys need to go to these schools." Well, they had no idea what was going on. Nobody explained it in their mother tongue to them, right? Mm-hmm. Kids were taken away almost automatically from them and not knowing where they were going. So it was traumatic, to say the least, mm-hmm. when you don't even know what's going on. You're separated from your parents for months and months. My mom, particularly, 10 months out of the year, no contact with their parents. And the other separation was she had a sister and a brother in the same school. They didn't even see each other that time in those 10 months.
Like that's how much the separation
was
entrenched.
Yeah. So the very limited time at Christmas and Easter, apparently, because those are the Christian holidays.
Well, and we should mention that.
Yeah.
That this whole program was sponsored by the Canadian government was the one leading this, but it was in cooperation with the local
number
church.
Of churches. I mean, it started off with Catholics and then Anglicans, Methodists, and eventually it went on to the Mennonites and the Baptists all joined in on this, saying this was okay.
Terry, how many kids died because of this?
Yeah, they say over 4,000 at that time. Oh. Yeah.
And that's not even meant just and, the abuse.
Yeah.
I mean, the kids were abused and died.
I mean, the part about kids dying, they never even went back to their parents. They were buried on the residential schools.
You can still see those graveyards.
You can. Mm-hmm. And they were never shipped back to the parents. They were buried there forever now. And a lot of them lost. After these schools shut down, they kind of got destroyed in that.
I just got to interject here because, I mean, we often talk about the meaning of life being relationship, and this is the complete opposite of that, and it was engineered by people, and the church is complicit in this. It just boggles my mind. I mean, you know, I have two kids. If the government came saying that we're going to kill the Asian in them and just took them away, just makes my blood boil, right?
Yeah.
That we were complicit in this.
Yeah, in my talk, I mean, I basically said the worst thing the church could have done, and because natives are all about relationship, is to take away that relationship from them, you know, and they thought that was a good idea to evangelize them as well, right? Not only did they want to separate, civilize them, they wanted to evangelize them and turn them into Christians. But they took away that one thing that it's what natives are all about, First Nations.
You know, something that's amazing amidst that is that still the gospel did go forth, and there are many indigenous people that love Jesus.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Like absolutely. Your mom.
My mom, she became a Christian at 22. And now she's 78, still a strong believer.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And so a couple things that we just need to highlight in there. First of all, I think it's important for people to know that the last residential school didn't close until
1996. A lot of people
think
this is
close. Isn't far in the past.
Yeah, this is right. Not 1800s.
This is very recent stuff, and people don't realize how recent it is. And a lot of people say, they just got to move on. That was way back then. Mm-hmm. It's not. I mean, I'll be doing a talk at the conference.
Yeah, the Apologetics Canada conference. Yeah,
Two Worlds Collide, Humanizing the Indigenous People of Canada. So if you guys want to join me there, we'll be talking about these issues and more.
Yeah, and if you can't make it out to the conference, you can always buy the audio. Well worth the investment.
I think the title is really appropriate given your background, right? Your mom was a full-blooded Cree.
Yep.
And your dad is English Scottish pastor.
Yeah.
And so when we say two worlds collide, we really mean it in your case, right?
Yeah. So a lot of my upbringing was on Native reserves or around them because my dad felt the need to minister to the natives. Mm-hmm. So we grew up around that. I often went back to Quebec and on the reserve, went out into the bush with my grandma and grandpa very often. Yeah. And it was a fantastic time.
Yeah, no, and this is fantastic because I think this really nicely brings us to this point that we begin to realize how important it is that we get our perspective straight and that both the Christian and the non-Christian can get their perspective, so out of focus, you know, that they don't even see another human being, whether that's a Congolese man or that's an indigenous, First Nations people in your own backyard.
And I'd like to address that in my talk as well. Our perspectives right now, as Christians and how we move forward in what it looks like now in the whole truth and reconciliation process. How can we be a part of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I even noticed that with myself. I was at a talk a couple years ago where I believe his name was Kenny Blackfeather was speaking. And he was incredibly articulate, smart, First Nations man that loves Jesus and just blew every paradigm away that I had of a native, right? I mean, a lot of us tend to have this idea, they're all this way, and you could put in there whatever you've come to think about another individual.
Right.
But these are what we have to understand, that these are dehumanizing, these are devaluing, and they're not true. But more than that, even if you did have an individual that was fitting the stereotype and, you put whatever, person in there that where you live, for example, in Portland, I grew up with Hispanic people. Now here in Abbotsford, there's a lot of people from India. And so it's easy to adopt those sorts of stereotypes. Now, what I'm saying, though, is looking past all that and seeing the humanity and asking this question. Does a person have inherent value? Is that value equal? And does it have rights that can't be taken away? Just playing off of this Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And this is where, as a Christian, we need to get that perspective. And Christianity allows us through the gospel to get that perspective straight so that I can see somebody clearly, which will affect the way that I care for that individual. Will affect the way that I love them. See, this is a critical idea that I want to get into that begins. There's so much stuff that we can get into, and unfortunately, just time, we're not going to be able to. That's in the Human Project. Maybe we'll do some follow up stuff. But I want to jump into having a correct perspective, and one of the areas that the Bible begins with having a correct perspective of a human being. Is first of all what we talked about last time, and that is that God created the universe, that God created people and made them with a purpose. This is the very foundation, the beginning of a foundation of human value. And we see that God continues to create, right? He creates not just the universe, not just life, not just a human being, so that we are the property of God Almighty. He created us. We belong to Him. And then God is continuing that purpose as the Bible explains in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 and 27, that God created us in His image.
Yeah, and that's a really critical idea. I found it always interesting if you read the book of Genesis, the early creation account there, just the way he creates human beings is different, right? Whereas all the other living beings, he just says, let there be. And there's all these animals and birds and things that crawl on the ground and fish and things like that. But with humanity, you see God actually, so to speak, getting his hands dirty. And he forms them out of the dirt and he actually breathes into them and becomes a living being. So very different from just speaking, you know, let there be. He actually puts a lot of extra care in creating human beings.
I would like to just stress that for a moment, because there was a time that people, as they studied the universe, from a perspective that they were the center of the solar system. They were the center of the universe. And so it was actually kind of difficult for them to understand that they actually weren't the center of our galaxy and we're not in the center of our solar system. But where did they get that idea? They got that idea because this is the idea that the Bible's communicating, is that humanity is the center of the creation purposes that God is doing. As he is creating the universe, as he's creating the planets, as he's creating life, everything is honing in on the main purpose that he's seeking to create, and that is a human being. And then we begin to narrow in even closer as that human being is created in his image and likeness.
Yeah. And the thing, too, is that we like to talk about equality a lot today, right? Mm-hmm. You take First Nations people, well, obviously they're equal to us. We're not better than them. They're not better than us. We're just equal. And then you can talk about LGBTQ rights and all that kind of stuff. So this idea of equality is really significant. But the question is, what binds all of that together?
What's the foundation?
Right, because the very concept of equality presupposes that we're different. Just as there can be no unity if there's no diversity, because then it's just a monolith, the idea of equality presupposes that we're all different. So the question is, what is it that brings all these different things, bringing them together, and then...
Which, by the way, we can see that we're all different, mm-hmm. right? Different ethnicities, different sizes...
Terry certainly has more hair than us.
Yeah.
I was thinking about mentioning that. But,
and that's actually an important point, because in our culture today, that's often how we try to find our value or to understand equality, is we'll compare ourselves to one another. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, we live in a comparison culture, right?
Yeah.
And how easy is it for me to go, oh, I'm from this country, or I make this amount of money, or, you know, I'm this ethnicity, or whatever it might be, or I live in this house. I mean, there is such a multiplicity of ways mm-hmm. that we can try to compare ourselves to one another to find some sort of value or equality. And what you find is there is the need for an objective standard. There's a need for a way of unifying us amongst our diversity that can't be taken away, and it doesn't come in degrees.
Yeah, that's exactly it, because if you try to place human value on the foundation of something that comes incrementally, then you have a problem, because then not everybody is equal, right? But just as we recognized in the UN Declaration of Human Rights, we recognize that we're all equal, where we have inherent dignity by the virtue of the fact that we're human.
Yeah. Again, we came in the world with this.
Right. And so when you try to place it on something that comes incrementally, like, for example, I know your niece suffers from cerebral palsy, right? I mean, and she was featured in the Human Project video there. Now, what's her value? And that's what she questions, right? I don't feel valuable, right? Because if you try to place human value on how able you are, of course you're going to, if you have cerebral palsy, you're going to think that you're less valuable than other people who are healthier.
I don't know if you guys saw the debate with Dr. Craig and Jordan Peterson and Rebecca Goldstein.
I think. And what wasn't it necessarily happened. A debate, it was more of a dialogue on the meaning of life.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Rebecca Goldstein would go, it seems like she'll go to her death defending the fact that we can create this meaning and this value in people through the evolutionary process.
Right.
And it's just stunning to listen to somebody that has, you know, doctorate degree, and to try to figure out how do they make that connection? You know, how do they make those value when you come from a
bunch of parts.
Yeah.
And bunch of stardust, as we talked about last time, or bag of chemicals. And what you find is that at best, it's just plain pretend. Now, I'm thankful that they want to play pretend that humans have value. Here's where I get concerned, though. What happens once that foundationless idea that the Declaration of Human Rights is founded on begins to be scratched away at or begins to be challenged? Mm. And there is no foundation there. There is nothing that can hold it up. I mean, there have been plenty of atheists throughout history who have had the willingness to show, listen, it's actually foundationless. Mm. But hey, for the sake of humanity, let's just pretend. The problem is, though, is we have a dangerous history lesson before us of people who are like, I'm not going to pretend about that guy or those people. They're not human. I mean, what worldview are you going to be able to challenge that? And this is the beauty of Christianity is under the Christian worldview, it's saying, listen, no, you are created by God. You're his possession. By the way, I love a quote by Gregory of Nyssa. He's a thinker from the 4th century. And he's speaking out against slavery, and he says, when someone turns the property of God into his own property and assumes dominion over his own kind so as to think himself the owner of men and women, what is he doing but overstepping his own nature through pride? Notice this, and he says, because he's regarding himself as something different from his subordinates. See, we're all created by God. And so you can start to see how this starts to set the foundation we've been talking about. And then the Bible explains further that not only are we the possession of God, we are all equally created by him and created in his image, an image that, again, doesn't come in degrees, nor can it be taken away. And this then theologically begins to set the stage for human value. And I want you to think about this. A lot of Christians even miss this point. And that is that if you want to understand human value, especially human value when we're talking about that humanity is created in the image of God, you begin to understand that the greater your view of God, the greater your view of humanity. And in Christianity has a high view of a holy God. And so it shouldn't surprise you then that Christianity has a high view of humanity. And in fact, this whole word humanism is a Christian idea. And really, we need to be careful when we talk about humanism, particularly when it's often used pejoratively as secular humanism. I mean, that's a different idea. Christianity is all about humanizing. And it's a humanizing religion in that the greater your view of God, the greater your view of humanity. So the most important view that you have in Christianity is your view of God because it informs your view of yourself. Now, I just want to say this is another important piece that I think a lot of people miss. The Ten Commandments begin by talking about your view of God and getting your view of God straight. And I think there's a lot of people that read their Bible and think, man, God has an identity crisis. Like, why does he keep going out of his way to make sure that I see him correctly? You know? And the reality is the Bible's going, listen, God doesn't have an identity crisis. He knows who he is. The problem is you don't know who you are. And if you want to know who you are, you've got to get a clear perspective of who God is because it's in God that you find your image and likeness. You were made in his image and likeness. But what we tend to do is we tend to seek to create ourselves in our own image and in our own likeness.
Or even create God in our own image.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
that's
we certainly need to stress, too, God's perspective of us, right? Just as much as our perspective of him, because it all came to a focus on Genesis 1:27. We keep on saying about the image of God. His love for us and the way he created us is his very pointed perspective.
And this is his purpose, right? Yep. Is to create us in his image. And we get into this We looked at this last time, that we were created for the purpose of relationship. And as we continue in Genesis, we see that sin and evil creep in to this purpose, that breaks this purpose that we were created for, relationship with God and relationship with one another. And to get back to your point there, Terry, yeah, we begin to see just how much God loves us, and you know who God is, in the depths that he will go to help us to fulfill that purpose we were created for through his son Jesus, who dies for us. You know, Jesus said, what greater gift can you give than to lay down your life for a friend? I mean, you could put it this way. What greater way to explain the value of human life than for God Almighty to send his son who willingly came and died for you on a cross so that you might fulfill the purpose that you were created for?
That's the, as John Lennox often puts it, that's the biggest compliment that God paid humanity, was for himself to come down in human form.
Absolutely. And I just want to make this last theological statement that I think is important for people to understand. That means then, when sin came into the world, when evil came into the world, you know, we got to be careful there, because oftentimes we'll talk about how the image of God was broken in us. And the reality is, the image of God was not broken. The image of God doesn't break. You know, God is holy and other, and he is God. And we are 100% made in the image of God, every single one of us. This is where our equality comes from. This is where our value comes from. The reality is that God's image isn't broken. We're broken. And that we have become poor reflections of the image that we were created in. We have marred the beauty of our true identity. And again, this is part of that human project that we're going to continue to discuss in the next session as we come back and look more clearly at, well, what does that look like then to become human, in that we fully reflect that image that we were created in that we begin to live out that purpose that we were created for.
Okay, I think we're going to wrap up there. We're out of time. If you guys want to learn more about The Human Project, again, go to thehumanproject.ca. It's thehumanproject.ca. And we'll come back next week with session 3 of The Human Project. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada. And we'll see you next week with session 3 of The Human Project.
If you enjoy and appreciate the AC podcast, show us some love on iTunes. Please consider leaving a review. It helps us keep doing what we're doing.